This is Audible.
The Ethical Slut, a practical guide to polyamory, open relationships, and other adventures. Second edition, unabridged. Narrated by the authors Dossie Easton and Janet W. Hardy. Produced by Allegra Bandy of Odawa Productions.
About the authors. Dossie Easton is a licensed marriage and family therapist specializing in alternative sexualities and relationships with 20 years of experience counseling open relationships. She is the author of 4 other books. She has been an ethical slut since 1969. You can visit her at www.dossieeaston.com. Janet W. Hardy is the author of more than 10 books and founder of Greenery Press, a San Francisco Bay Area book publisher specializing in sexually adventurous books. She has an MFA in creative writing from St. Mary's College. She swore off monogamy in 1987. Visit her at www.janetwhardy.com. Dossie and Janet have authored several other books available from Greenery Press. Part 1. Welcome. Chapter 1. Who is an ethical slut? Many people dream of having an abundance of love and sex and friendship. Some believe that such a life is impossible and settle for less than they want, feeling always a little lonely, a little frustrated. Others try to achieve their dream but are thwarted by outside social pressures or by their own emotions and decide that such dreams must stay in the realm of fantasy. A few, though, persist and discover that being openly loving, intimate, and sexual with many people is not only possible, but can be more rewarding than they ever imagined. People have been succeeding at free love for many centuries, often quietly without much fanfare. In this book, we will share the techniques, the skills, the ideals that have made it work for them. So who is an ethical slut? We are. Many, many others are. Maybe you are too. If you dream of freedom, if you dream of intimacy both hot and profound, if you dream of an abundance of friends and flirtation and affection, of following your desires and seeing where they take you, you've already taken the first step. Why we chose this title? From the moment you saw or heard about this book, you probably guessed that some of the terms here may not have the same meanings you're accustomed to. What kind of people would revel in calling themselves sluts? And why would they insist on being recognized for their ethics? In most of the world, slut is a highly offensive term used to describe a woman whose sexuality is voracious, indiscriminate, and shameful. It's interesting to note that the analogous word stud, used to describe a highly sexual man, is often a term of approval and envy. If you ask about a man's morals, you will probably hear about his honesty, loyalty, integrity, and high principles. When you ask about a woman's morals, you are more likely to hear about whom she shares sex with and under what conditions. We have a problem with this. So we are proud to reclaim the word slut as a term of approval, even endearment. To us, a slut is a person of any gender who celebrates sexuality according to the radical proposition that sex is nice and pleasure is good for you. Sluts may choose to have solo sex or to get cozy with the Fifth Fleet. They may be heterosexual, homosexual, or bisexual, radical activists, or peaceful suburbanites. As proud sluts, we believe that sex and sexual love are fundamental forces for good, activities with the potential to strengthen intimate bonds, enhance lives, open spiritual awareness, even change the world. Furthermore, we believe that every consensual sexual relationship has these potentials, and that any erotic pathway, consciously chosen and mindfully followed, can be a positive creative force in the lives of individuals and their communities. Sluts share their sexuality the way philanthropists share their money. Because they have a lot of it to share, because it makes them happy to share it, because sharing makes the world a better place. Sluts often find that the more love and sex they give away, the more they have. A loaves and fishes miracle in which greed and generosity go hand in hand to provide more for everybody. Imagine living in sexual abundance. Your authors. Between us, we represent a fairly large slice of the pie that is sexual diversity. Dossie is a therapist in private practice in San Francisco, specializing in relationship issues and alternative sexualities. She has identified as lesbian for the past 25 years and still values her experience as both bisexual and heterosexual before that. She has always been a slut. She committed to an open sexual lifestyle in 1969 when her daughter was newborn and taught her first workshop on unlearning jealousy in 1973. She has spent about half of her adult life living single, sort of, with families of housemates, lovers, and other intimates. She currently makes her home with her partner in the mountains north of San Francisco. Many of you may remember Janet from the last edition of this book as Catherine A. List, a pen name she used back then when her sons were still minors. Now that they're grown and independent, she has gone back to using her real name. Janet lived as a teenage slut in college, but then essayed monogamy in a traditional heterosexual marriage for well over a decade. Since the end of that marriage, she has not considered monogamy an option for her. While most people would call her bisexual, she thinks of herself as gender-bent and can't quite figure out how sexual orientation is supposed to work when you're sometimes male and sometimes female. She's married to a bio guy whose gender is as flexible as hers, which is less complicated than it sounds. She makes her living as a writer, publisher, and teacher. Together, we have been lovers, dear friends, co-authors, and co-conspirators for a decade and a half, in and out of various other relationships, homes, and projects. We are both mothers of grown children, both active in the BDSM leather kink communities, and both creative writers, Dossie of poetry, Janet of personal essays. We think we're an excellent example of what can happen if you don't try to force all your relationships into the monogamous till death do us part model. Sexual adventurers. The world generally views sluts as debased, degraded, promiscuous, indiscriminate, jaded, immoral adventurers. Destructive, out of control, and driven by some form of psychopathology that prevents them from entering into a healthy, monogamous relationship. Oh yes, and definitely not ethical. We see ourselves as people who are committed to finding a place of sanity with sex and relationships, and to freeing ourselves to enjoy sex and sexual love in as many ways as may fit for each of us. We may not always know what fits without trying it on, so we tend to be curious and adventurous. When we see someone who intrigues us, we like to feel free to respond, and, as we explore our response, to discover whatever is special about this new, fascinating person. We like relating to people and are quite gregarious, enjoying the company of different kinds of people, and reveling in how our differences expand our horizons and offer us new ways to be ourselves. Sluts tend to want a lot of things. Different forms of sexual expression, different people, perhaps men or women or people in between, or some of each. We are curious. What would it be like to combine the energies of four or five people in one incandescent sexual encounter? What would it be like to share erotic energy with that person who has been your best friend for years and years? What would it be like to share a household with multiple friends and lovers? What would it be like to be intimate with someone who is very different from us? Of course, each slut is unique with virtues and faults and diverse needs and values. Some of us express different parts of ourselves with different people. Some of us love flirtation for its own sake. Some of us make an art form out of sex. Some of us find these parts of our lives so important that sluttiness is a basic part of our identity, one of the ways we define ourselves, while others drift in and out of sluttiness according to desire and circumstance. Sluts are not necessarily sexual athletes, although many of us do train more than most. We value sex, not as a way to set records, but for the pleasure it brings us and the good times we get to share with however many wonderful people. We love adventure. The word adventurer is sometimes used pejoratively, suggesting that the adventurous person is immature or inauthentic, not really willing to grow up and settle down into a presumably monogamous lifestyle. We wonder, what's wrong with having adventures? Can't we have adventures and still raise children, buy houses, and do the work that's important to us? Of course we can. Sluts qualify for mortgages just like everybody else. We tend to like our lives complicated, and the challenge of maintaining stable work and home lives while discovering new people and ideas is just what we need to keep us interested and engaged. One of the most valuable things we learn from open sexual lifestyles is that our programming about love, intimacy, and sex can be rewritten. When we begin to question all the ways we have been told we ought to be, we can begin to edit and rewrite our old tapes. By breaking the rules, we both free and empower ourselves. We hate boredom. We are people who are greedy to experience all that life has to offer and are also generous in sharing what we have to offer. We love to be the good time had by all. What's new here? In the decade plus since we wrote the first edition of The Ethical Slut, we've learned a lot. Dossie, in her therapy practice, has worked with hundreds of singles, couples, and moresomes who are trying to navigate the uncharted pathways of non-traditional relationships, and she has developed new concepts and tools that have proven very helpful to them. Janet has moved out of the relationship she was in the last time you saw her, has spent several years as a single slut, and has negotiated a relationship with a new lover who went on to become her legal spouse. We've also become, if we say so ourselves, better writers, both individually and together. If you read the first edition of this book, you'll see a lot of new material in here, and you'll notice that the old material has been substantially rewritten and reorganized. You'll also notice one major change. This book contains many exercises that you can use to explore your feelings and chart your progress as you read the book, either on your own or together with a partner or partners. So, whether you're an old friend or a new acquaintance, we're happy to welcome you into our book and into our slutty, happy lives. The language in this book. When you sit down to write a book about sex, as we hope you one day will, you will discover that centuries of censorship have left us with very little adequate language with which to discuss the joys and occasional worries of sex. The language that we do have often carries implicit judgments. If the only polite way to talk about sexuality is in medical Latin, vulvas and pudendas, penis and testes, are only doctors allowed to talk about sex? Is sex all about disease? Meanwhile, most of the originally English words, cock and cunt, fucking and, oh yes, slut, have been used as insults to degrade people and their sexuality and often have a hostile or coarse feel to them. Euphemisms, peepees and pussies, jade gates and mighty towers, sound as if we are embarrassed. Maybe we are. Our approach to a sex-positive language is to reclaim the original English words and, by using them as positive descriptors, wash them clean. Hence our adoption of the word slut. You will also find in this book words like fuck and cock and cunt, used not as insults, but to mean what they actually mean. Furthermore, cultural blind spots can show up as centrisms, such as couple-centrism, heterocentrism, and eurocentrism. Non-monogamy, extramarital sex, open relationships, all define themselves by what they aren't, thus implying that there's some exception to the normal relationships that normal people have. Polyamory is a brave new word, coined by Morning Glory Raven Hart Zell around 1990, and currently we are thrilled to report included in the Oxford English Dictionary. Formed from Latin and Greek roots that translate as loving many, this word has been adopted by many sluts to describe their lifestyles, often abbreviated as poly, as in I am a poly person. Some use it to mean multiple committed live-in relationships, forms of group marriage. Others use it as an umbrella word to cover all forms of sex and love and domesticity outside conventional monogamy. Polyamory has moved into the language so rapidly that we think maybe the language has been waiting for it for a very long time. In this new world of sex and relationships, new terms get coined all the time to describe, or attempt to describe, the ever-changing spectrum of ways in which people arrange their lives. Finally, we are doing our best to make the language in this book as pansexual and gender-neutral as we can. We are writing this book for everybody. Pansexual means including everyone as a sexual being. Straight, bi, lesbian, gay, transgendered, queer, old, young, disabled, perverts, male, female, questioning, in transition. The examples and quotes in this book have been drawn from throughout the huge array of lifestyles we have encountered in our combined 7 decades of sluthood. There are infinite right ways to be sexual, and we want to affirm all of them. Chapter 2: Myths and Realities. Those who set off down the path of exploring new kinds of relationships and new lifestyles often find themselves blocked by beliefs about the way society should be, the way relationships should be, the way people should be, that are both deeply rooted and unexamined. We have all been taught that one way of relating, lifelong monogamous heterosexual marriage, is the only right way. We are told that monogamy is normal and natural. If our desires do not fit into that constraint, we are morally deficient, psychologically disturbed, and going against nature. Many of us feel instinctively that something is wrong with this picture, but how can you dig up and examine a belief that you don't even know you hold? The ideal of lifelong monogamy as the only proper goal for relationships is so deeply buried in our culture that it's almost invisible. We operate on these beliefs without even knowing we believe them. They're under our feet all the time. The foundation for our assumptions, our values, our desires, our myths, our expectations. We don't notice them until we trip over them. Where do these beliefs get started? Often they evolve to meet conditions that no longer exist. Our beliefs about traditional marriage date from agrarian cultures, where you made everything you ate or wore or used, where large extended families helped get this huge amount of work done so nobody starved, and where marriage was a working proposition. When we talk about traditional family values, this is the family we are talking about. An extended family of grandparents and aunts and cousins, an organization to accomplish the work of staying alive. We see large families functioning in traditional ways in America today, often in cultures recently transplanted from other countries, or as a basic support system among economically vulnerable urban or rural populations. Curiously, controlling sexual behavior didn't seem to be that important outside the propertied classes until the Industrial Revolution, which launched a whole new era of sex negativity, perhaps because of the rising middle class and the limited space for children in urban cultures. Doctors and ministers in the late 18th century began to claim that masturbation was unhealthy and sinful, that this most innocent of sexual outlets was dangerous to society. 19th century child-rearing manuals showed devices to prevent babies from touching their genitals in their sleep. So any desire for sex, even with yourself, became a shameful secret. But human nature will win out. We are horny creatures. And the more sexually repressive a culture becomes, the more outrageous its covert sexual thoughts and behaviors will become, as any fan of Victorian porn can attest. In his lectures to young communists in Germany during the rise of Hitler and the Nazis, psychologist Wilhelm Reich theorized that the suppression of sexuality was essential to an authoritarian government. Without the imposition of anti-sexual morality, he believed, people would be free from shame and would trust their own sense of right and wrong. They would be unlikely to march to war against their wishes or to operate death camps. Perhaps if we were raised without shame and guilt about our desires, we might be freer people in more ways than simply the sexual. The nuclear family, which consists of parents and children relatively isolated from the extended family, is a relic of the 20th century middle class. Children no longer work on the farm or in the family business. They're raised almost like pets. Modern marriage is no longer essential for survival. Now we marry in pursuit of comfort, security, sex, intimacy, and emotional connection. The increase in divorce, so deplored by today's religious right, may simply reflect the economic reality that today most of us can afford to leave relationships in which we are not happy. Nobody will starve. And still modern Puritans, perhaps not yet ready to deal with the frightening prospect of truly free sexual and romantic choice, attempt to enforce the nuclear family and monogamous marriage by teaching sexual shame. We believe that the current set of oddities, and any other set, are cultural artifacts. We believe that nature is wondrously diverse, offering us infinite possibilities. We would like to live in a culture that respects the choices made by sluts as highly as we respect the couple celebrating their 50th anniversary. And come to think of it, what makes us assume that such a couple is monogamous anyway? We are paving new roads across new territory. We have no culturally approved scripts for open sexual lifestyles. We need to write our own. To write your own script requires a lot of effort and a lot of honesty and is the kind of hard work that brings many rewards. You may find the right way for you and 3 years from now decide you want to live a different way, and that's fine. You write the script, you get to make the choices, and you get to change your mind, too.
Exercise, sluts we know and love. Make a list of all the people you can think of who are not monogamous, including characters from TV, movies, books, and so on. How do you feel about each of them? What can you learn, positive or negative, from him or her?
Judgments about sluts. As you try to figure out your own path, you may encounter a lot of harsh judgments about the ways different people live. We're sure you don't need us to tell you that the world does not, for the most part, honor sluthood, or think well of those of us who are sexually explorative. You will probably find some of these judgments in your own brain, burrowed in deeper than you ever realized. We believe that they say a lot more about the culture that promotes them than they do about any actual person, including you. Judgment number one, promiscuous. This means we enjoy too many sexual partners. We've also been called indiscriminate in our sexuality, which we resent. We can always tell our lovers apart. We do not believe that there is such a thing as too much sex, except perhaps on certain happy occasions when our options exceed our abilities. Nor do we believe that the ethics we are talking about here have anything to do with moderation or abstinence. Kinsey once defined a nymphomaniac as someone who has more sex than you, and, scientist that he was, demonstrated his point with statistics. Is having less sex somehow more virtuous than having more? we think not. We measure the ethics of good sluts not by the number of their partners, but by the respect and care with which they treat them. Judgment number two, amoral. Our culture also tells us that sluts are evil, uncaring, amoral, and destructive. Jezebel, Casanova, Don Juan. The mythological evil slut is grasping and manipulative, seeking to steal something, virtue, money, self-esteem, from his partners. In some ways, this archetype is based on the idea that sex is a commodity, a coin you trade for something else. Stability, children, a wedding ring. And that any other transaction constitutes being cheated and betrayed. We have rarely observed any Jezebels or Casanovas in our community, but perhaps it is not very satisfying for a thief to steal what is freely given. We do not worry about being robbed of our sexual value by the people we share pleasure with. Judgment number three, sinful. Some people base their sense of ethics on what they've been told that God or their church or their parents or their culture believes to be okay or not okay. They believe that being good consists of obedience to laws set down by a power greater than themselves. Religion, we think, has a great deal to offer to many people, the comfort of faith and the security of community among them. But believing that God doesn't like sex, as many religions seem to, is like believing that God doesn't like you. Because of this belief, a tremendous number of people carry great shame for their own perfectly natural sexual desires and activities. We prefer the beliefs of a woman we met, a devoted churchgoer in a fundamentalist faith. She told us that when she was about 5 years old, she discovered the joys of masturbation in the back seat of the family car, tucked under a warm blanket on a long trip. It felt so wonderful that she concluded that the existence of her clitoris was proof positive that God loved her. Judgment number four, pathological. When psychological studies of human behavior came into vogue in the late 19th century, Kraft, Ebbing, and Freud attempted to create more tolerance by theorizing that sluts are not bad but sick, suffering from psychopathology that is not their fault, since their neurosis derives from having their sexuality warped by their parents during their toilet training. So, they said, we should no longer burn sluts at the stake, but instead send them to mental hospitals to be cured, in an environment that permits no sexual expression at all, healthy or otherwise. During your author's childhood and adolescence in the early 1960s, it was common practice to certify and incarcerate adolescents for treatment of the illness of being sexual, especially if they were gay or lesbian, or female, and in danger of damaging their market value as virgins. This sort of thing still takes place more often than you might think. More recently, we hear about sex addicts, avoidance of intimacy, commitment phobia, and attachment disorders. These terms were created to describe genuine problems, but they are far too often used as weapons in a moral war against all sexual freedom. The whole idea of sex addiction is a controversial one. Many people feel that the word addiction is not well suited to discussing behavioral issues like sex. However, everybody seems to agree that substituting sex for fulfillment of other needs, to allay anxiety, for instance, or bolster sagging self-esteem, represents a problem. Only you can decide whether your sexual behaviors have become compulsive and whether you wish to change them. Some people try to validate their sexual attractiveness over and over, using sex as a constant reassurance because they do not see themselves as inherently attractive or lovable. Sex can be used as a substitute for connection. Sex can be the only coin valuable enough to attract attention and approval. Some 12-step groups and therapists who subscribe to the addiction model may try to tell you that anything but the most conservative of sexual behaviors is wrong or unhealthy or into your addiction. We encourage you to trust your own beliefs and find yourself a supportive environment. Sexual Compulsives Anonymous and Sex Addicts Anonymous encourage you to define the healthy sex life you want for yourself. If your goal is monogamy, that's fine. And if your goal is to stop seeking sex in the place of friendship or any other behavior pattern that you wish to re-sculpt, that's fine too. We do not believe that successfully recovering sex addicts have to be monogamous unless they want to be. Judgment number 5. Easy. Is there, we wonder, some virtue in being difficult? Myths about sluts. One of the challenges facing the ethical slut is our culture's insistence that simply because everybody knows something, it must obviously be true. We urge you to regard with great skepticism any sentence that begins, "Everybody knows that," or "Common sense tells us that," or "It's common knowledge that." Often these phrases are signposts for cultural belief systems that may be anti-sexual, monogamy-centrist, and or codependent. Questioning what everybody does can be difficult and disorienting, but we have found it to be rewarding. Questioning is the first step toward generating a new paradigm, your own paradigm of how you ought to be. Cultural belief systems can be very deeply rooted in literature, law, and archetypes, which means that shaking them from your own personal ethos can be difficult. But the first step in exploring them is, of course, recognizing them. Here, then, are some of the pervasive myths that we have heard all our lives and have come to understand are most often untrue and destructive to our relationships and our lives. Myth number 1. Long-term monogamous relationships are the only real relationships. Lifetime monogamy as an ideal is a relatively new concept in human history and makes us unique among primates. There is nothing that can be achieved within a long-term monogamous relationship that cannot be achieved without one. Business partnership, deep attachment, stable parenting, personal growth, care and companionship in old age are all well within the abilities of the slut. People who believe this myth may feel that something is wrong with them if they aren't in a committed twosome. If they prefer to remain free agents, if they discover themselves loving more than one person at a time, if they have tried one or more traditional relationships that didn't work out. Instead of questioning the myth, they question themselves. Am I incomplete? Where is my other half? The myth teaches them that they are not good enough in and of themselves. Often people develop a very unrealistic view of couplehood. Mr. or Ms. Right will automatically solve all their problems, fill all the gaps, make their lives complete. A subset of this myth is the belief that if you are really in love, you will automatically lose all interest in others. Thus, if you're having sexual or romantic feelings toward anyone but your partner, you're not really in love. This belief has caused many people a great deal of happiness throughout the centuries, yet is untrue to the point of absurdity. A ring around the finger does not cause a nerve block to the genitals. And we must ask if monogamy is the only acceptable option, the only true form of love, then are these agreements genuinely consensual? We have many friends who have chosen to be monogamous, and we applaud them. But how many people in our society consciously make that choice? Myth number 2. Romantic love is the only real love. Look at the lyrics of popular songs or read some classical poetry. The phrases we choose to describe romantic love don't really sound all that pleasant. Crazy in love, love hurts, obsession, heartbreak. These are all descriptions of mental or physical illness. The thing that gets called romantic love in this culture seems to be a heady cocktail of lust and adrenaline, sparked by uncertainty, insecurity, perhaps even anger or danger. The chills up the spine that we recognize as passion are, in fact, the same physical phenomenon as hair rising up on a cat's back and are caused by the fight-or-flight response. This kind of love can be thrilling and overwhelming and sometimes a hell of a lot of fun. But it is not the only real kind of love, nor is it always a good basis for an ongoing relationship. Yet, as George Bernard Shaw famously remarked, when two people are under the influence of the most violent, most insane, most delusive, and most transient of passions, they are required to swear that they will remain in that excited, abnormal, and exhausting condition continuously until death do them part. Myth number 3. Sexual desire is a destructive force. This one goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden and leads to a lot of crazy-making double standards. Some religions appear to believe that women's sexuality is evil and dangerous and exists only to lure men to their doom. From the Victorian era, we get the idea that men are hopelessly voracious and predatory when it comes to sex, and women are supposed to control and civilize them by being pure, asexual, and withholding. Men are the gas pedal and women are the brakes, which is, we think, pretty hard on the engine. Neither of these works for us. Many people also believe that unashamed sexual desire, particularly desire for more than one person, inevitably destroys the family. Yet we suspect that far more families have been destroyed by bitter divorces over adultery than have ever been disturbed by ethical, consensual non-monogamy. Myth number 4. Loving someone makes it okay to control his or her behavior. This kind of territorial reasoning is designed, we guess, to make people feel secure. But we don't believe that anybody has the right, much less the obligation, to control the behavior of another functioning adult. Being treated according to this myth doesn't make us feel secure. It makes us feel furious. The old, "Oh, she's jealous, she must really care about me," reasoning, or the scene in which the girl falls in love with the boy when he punches out a rival suitor, are symptomatic of a very disturbed set of personal boundaries that can lead to a great deal of unhappiness. This myth also leads to the belief, so often promulgated in Hollywood films and popular literature, that sleeping with someone else is something you do to your partner, not for yourself, and is, moreover, the very worst thing you can do to someone. For many years, in New York State, adultery was the only legally acceptable grounds for divorce, leaving those who had unfortunately married batterers or drunks in a very difficult position. And the legal punishment for cheating could be to lose one's job, home, money, and kids because of the wounding to the betrayed partner, that is, if you got caught. So one was supposed to cheat in secrecy to protect one's partner's dignity and keep the family together. Myth number 5. Jealousy is inevitable and impossible to overcome. Jealousy is, without a doubt, a very common experience. So much so that a person who doesn't experience jealousy is looked at as a bit odd, or in denial. But often a situation that would cause intense jealousy for one person can be no big deal for another. Some people get jealous when their honey takes a sip out of someone else's Coke. Others happily watch their beloved wave bye-bye for a month of amorous sporting with a friend at the far end of the country. Some people also believe that jealousy is such a shattering emotion that they have no choice but to succumb to it. People who believe this often believe that any form of non-monogamy should be non-consensual and completely secret, in order to protect the betrayed partner from having to feel such an impossibly difficult emotion. On the contrary, we have found that jealousy is an emotion like any other. It feels bad, sometimes very bad, but it is not intolerable. We have also found that many of the oddities that lead to jealousy can be unlearned, and that unlearning them is often a useful process. Later in this book, we will spend a lot more time talking about jealousy and the strategies many people have successfully employed to cope with it. Myth number 6. Outside involvements reduce intimacy in the primary relationship. Most marriage counselors and certain popular TV psychologists believe when a member of an otherwise happy couple has an affair, this must be a symptom of unresolved conflict or unfulfilled needs that should be dealt with in the primary relationship. Of course, this is occasionally true, but not nearly as often as many relationship gurus would like us to believe. Moreover, this myth leaves no room for the possibility of growthful and constructive open sexual lifestyles. It is cruel and insensitive to interpret an affair as a symptom of sickness in the relationship, as it leaves cheated-on partners, who may already be feeling insecure, to wonder what is wrong with them. Meanwhile, cheating partners get told that they are only trying to get back at their primary partners and don't really want, need, or even like their lovers. Many people have sex outside their primary relationships for reasons that have nothing to do with any inadequacy in their partner or in the relationship. The new relationship may simply be a natural extension of an emotional and/or physical attraction to someone besides the primary partner. Or perhaps this outside relationship allows a particular kind of intimacy that the primary partner doesn't even want, such as kinky sex or going to football games, and thus constitutes a solution for an otherwise insoluble conflict. Or perhaps it meets other needs, like a need for uncomplicated physical sex without the trappings of relationship, or for sex with someone of a gender other than one's partner's, or for sex at a time when it is otherwise not available, during travel or a partner's illness, for example. An outside involvement does not have to subtract in any way from the intimacy you share with your partner unless you let it, and we sincerely hope you won't. Myth number 7. Love conquers all. Hollywood tells us that love means never having to say you're sorry, and we, fools that we are, believe it. This myth has it that if you're really in love with someone, you never have to argue, disagree, communicate, negotiate, or do any other kind of work. It also tells us that love means we automatically get turned on by our beloved and that we never have to lift a finger or make any effort to deliberately kindle passion. Those who believe this myth may find themselves feeling that their love has failed every time they need to schedule a discussion or have a courteous or not so courteous disagreement. They may also believe that any sexual behavior that doesn't fit their criteria for normal sex, from fantasies to vibrators, is artificial and indicates that something is lacking in the quality of their love.
Exercise. Why sluthood? Why not? Write a list of every reason you can think of that any person anywhere might want to be a slut. You can do this on your own, or with a friend or a lover. Which of these tell you what kind of slut you don't want to be? Which of these are your very good and valid reasons?
Steps to a freer paradigm. So in this slightly disorienting world of sluthood, in which everything your mom, your minister, your spouse and your television ever told you is probably wrong? How do you find new beliefs that support your new lifestyle? Letting go of old paradigms can leave you in a scary emptiness, your stomach churning as if you were in free fall. You don't need the old myths, but what will you have instead? We encourage you to seek your own truths on your way to slutty bliss. But just in case you could use a hint or two, here are some of the ones that have worked well for us. Chapter 3. Our beliefs. We are ethical people, ethical sluts. It is very important to us to treat people well and to do our best not to hurt anyone. Our ethics come from our own sense of rightness and from the empathy and love we hold for those around us. It is not okay to hurt another person because then we hurt too and we don't feel good about ourselves. Ethical slutdom can be a challenging path. We don't have a polyamorous Miss Manners telling us how to do our thing courteously and respectfully, so we have to make it up as we go along. However, we're sure you figured out by now that to us, being a slut doesn't mean simply doing whatever you want, whenever you want, with whomever you want. Most of our criteria for ethics are quite pragmatic. Is anyone being harmed? Is there any way to avoid causing that harm? Are there any risks? Is everybody involved aware of those risks and doing what can be done to minimize them? On the positive side, how much fun is this? What is everybody learning from it? Is it helping someone to grow? Is it helping make the world a better place? First and foremost, ethical sluts value consent. When we use this word, and we will often throughout this book, we mean an active collaboration for the benefit, well-being, and pleasure of all persons concerned. If someone is being coerced, bullied, blackmailed, manipulated, lied to, or ignored, what is happening is not consensual. And sex that is not consensual is not ethical, period. Ethical sluts are honest with ourselves and others. We take time with ourselves to figure out our own emotions and motivations and to untangle them for greater clarity when necessary. Then we openly share that information with those who need it. We do our best not to let our fears and bashfulness be an obstacle to our honesty. We trust that our partners will go on respecting and loving us, warts and all. Ethical sluts recognize the ramifications of our sexual choices. We see that our emotions, our upbringing, and the standards of our culture often conflict with our sexual desires, and we make a conscious commitment to supporting ourselves and our partners as we deal with those conflicts honestly and honorably. We do not allow our sexual choices to have an unnecessary impact on those who have not consented to participate. We are respectful of others' feelings, and when we aren't sure how someone feels, we ask. Ethical sluts recognize the difference between things they can and should control and things they can't. While we sometimes may feel jealous or territorial, we own those feelings, doing our best not to blame or control, but asking for the support we need to help ourselves feel safe and cared for. Don't panic. The rest of this book is about how you can learn to be such a fine, sexy grown-up. Your authors are here to help. We wrote this book to help you become an ethical slut. Here are a few of the ideas and beliefs that have helped us get here and might help you, too. Rethinking sex. Are you having sex right now? Yes, you are, and so are we. Perhaps you're looking around you in bewilderment. You still have your clothing on, and maybe you're sitting in a restaurant or a crowded bus. How could you be having sex? We think that the question of when you're having sex is actually sort of meaningless. Sexual energy pervades everything all the time. We inhale it into our lungs and exude it from our pores. While it's pretty easy to determine whether or not you're engaging in a particular sexual activity at any given time, neither you nor we are probably having intercourse at this moment, The idea of sex as something set aside, a discrete, definable activity like driving a car, just doesn't hold up very well. You can compare this to the idea of eating, if you like. Most people would define eating as the actual activity of placing food in the mouth. But gourmets might spend a long time savoring the aroma and appearance of their food before actually taking a bite, so that smell and vision have become part of eating. For those who open themselves to the possibilities, every stray aroma that floats under our nostrils, the ocean breeze with its tang of oysters and seaweed, the peaty whiskey-like whiff of wood smoke, becomes a kind of eating. And our eyes take in colors and shapes, apple red and creamy custard yellow, while our busy brains, remembering yesterday's wonderful meal, plan another for tomorrow, and the whole world becomes our food. Similarly, we think erotic energy is everywhere. In the deep breath that fills our lungs as we step out into a warm spring morning, in the cold water spilling over the rocks in a brook, in the creativity that drives us to paint pictures and tell stories and make music and write books, in the loving tenderness we feel toward our friends and relatives and children. In our combined half century of work as sex writers and educators, we found that the more we learn about sex, the less we know about how to define it. So now we just say the truth as we know it. Sex is part of everything. Right now, we're writing about sex and you're reading what we have to say about it. You're having sex with us. Was it good for you? It sure has been for us. More pragmatically, we have had long, intense, intimate conversations that felt deeply sexual to us. And we have had intercourse that didn't feel terribly sexual. Our best definition here is that sex is whatever the people engaging in it think it is. For some people, spanking is sex. For others, wearing a garter belt and stockings is sex. If you and anybody else involved feel sexual when you eat ice cream sundaes together, that's sex. You. While this may sound silly now, it's a concept that will come in handy later in this book when we discuss making agreements about our sexual behaviors. Denial versus fulfillment. Dossie's bachelor's thesis was called Sex is Nice and Pleasure is Good for You. That idea is as radical now in the 21st century as it was back in the 1970s when Dossie first wrote it. Our culture places a very high value on self-denial, which is fine when there is hard work to be done. But all too often, those who unapologetically satisfy their desire for pleasure in their utterly free time are seen as immature, disgusting, even sinful. Since we all have desires, puritanical values lead inevitably to self-loathing, hatred of our bodies and our turn-ons, and fear and guilt over our sexual urges. We see ourselves surrounded by the walking wounded, by people who have been deeply injured by fear, shame, and hatred of their own sexual selves. We believe that happy, free, guiltless connection is the cure for these wounds. We believe that sexuality is vital to people's sense of self-worth, to their belief that life is good. We have never met anyone who had low self-esteem at the moment of orgasm. You don't need a reason. If you walk up to a randomly selected individual and propose that sex is nice and pleasure is good for you, you will probably hear a lot of spluttering, argument and yabats, STDs, unwanted pregnancies, rape, the commodification of sexual desire, and so on, none of which changes the core idea. There is nothing in the world so terrific that it can't be abused if you're determined to do so. Familial connections can be violated. Sexual desire can be manipulated. Even chocolate can be abused. Abuse doesn't change the basic wonderfulness of any of these things. The danger lies in the motivation of the abuser, not the nature of the item. If there were no such thing as sexually transmitted disease, if nobody got pregnant unless she wanted to, if all sex were consensual and pleasurable, how would the world feel about it then? How would you feel? If you look deep inside yourself, you may find bits and pieces of sex negativism, often hiding behind judgmental words like promiscuous, hedonistic, decadent, and non-productive. Even people who consider themselves sex positive and sexually liberated often fall into a different trap, the trap of rationalizing sex. Releasing physical tension, relieving menstrual cramps, maintaining mental health, preventing prostate problems, making babies, cementing relationships, and so on, are all admirable goals and wonderful side benefits of sex. But they are not what sex is for. Sex is for pleasure, a complete and worthwhile goal in and of itself. People have sex because it feels very good, and then they feel good about themselves. The worthiness of pleasure is one of the core values of ethical sluthood. Love and sex are the end, not the means. Our monogamy-centrist culture tends to assume that the purpose and ultimate goal of all relationships and all sex is lifelong pair bonding, and that any relationship that falls short of that goal has failed. We, on the other hand, think sexual pleasure can certainly contribute to love, commitment, and long-term stability, if that's what you want. But those are hardly the only good reasons for having sex. We believe in valuing relationships for what we value in them, a seeming tautology that is wiser than it sounds. A relationship may be valuable simply because it affords sexual pleasure to those involved. There is nothing wrong with sex for sex's sake. Or it might involve sex as a pathway to other lovely things, intimacy, connection, companionship, even romantic love, which in no way changes the basic goodness of the pleasurable sex. A sexual relationship may last for an hour or two. It's still a relationship. The participants have related to one another. As sex partners, companions, lovers, for the duration of their interaction. Longevity is not a good criterion by which to judge the success or failure of a relationship. One-night stands can be intense, life-enhancing, and fulfilling. So can lifetime love affairs. While ethical sluts may choose to have some kinds of relationships and not others, we believe that all relationships have the potential to teach us, move us, and above all, give us pleasure. Dossie remembers an interview with a young flower child back in 1967 who made the most succinct statement of ethical sluthood we've ever seen. We believe it's okay to have sex with anybody you love, and we believe in loving everybody. You are already whole. Jane Austen wrote, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife." While we think Jane probably had her tongue firmly planted in her cheek, a great many people do believe that to be single is to be somehow incomplete, and that they need to find their other half. A lot of the myths we mentioned in the previous section are based on that belief. We believe, on the other hand, that the fundamental sexual unit is one person. Adding more people to that unit may be intimate, fun, and companionable, but does not complete anybody. The only thing in this world that you can control is yourself, your own reactions, desires, and behaviors. Thus, a fundamental step in ethical sluthood is to bring your locus of control into yourself, to recognize the difference between your stuff and other people's. When you do this, you become able to complete yourself. That's why we call this integrity. When you have built a satisfying relationship with yourself, then you have something of great worth to share with others. Abundance is entirely available. Many people believe explicitly or implicitly that our capacities for romantic love, intimacy, and connection are finite. That there is never enough to go around, and that if you give some to one person, you must be taking some away from another. We call this belief a starvation economy. We'll talk much more about it later. Many of us learned to think this way in childhood from parents who had little affection or attention for us, so we learned that there is only a limited amount of love in the world, and we have to fight for whatever we get, often in cutthroat competition with our brothers and sisters.